to market to market, to the farmer's market, for food with its farmer's face on it, ambience that is small town friendly, and people that are as real as the goods in their hands. Just ask the Blythe farmer.
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 502nd edition of the Food Chain Radio program right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends way down there in Cusco who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Aaron Bond on the boards. Hello, Aaron.
Hello, Michael.
Producer Carol Stafford on the phones. Hello, Carol.
Hello.
And producer Kelsey Olson on the story. Hello, Kelsey.
Hello.
Boy, I got the girls today. I'm in business. Folks, agriculture, like all business, seems to be growing in two directions. Very, very big or very, very small. Everything in the middle is, roadkill. The culture of agriculture is also growing in two directions. Those producers who have become very, very big call themselves growers. Their goods are packaged tightly in brightly colored plastic and shipped thousands of miles to the gleaming shelves of some big box store. With the exception of a board checker, we shoppers are hard-pressed to find any culture in that agriculture anymore. On the other hand, those producers who have become small still call themselves farmers. Their goods are harvested fresh and trucked a few miles to a local grocery store, a restaurant, or a farmer's market. If we shoppers care to look, we'll find more culture than we can possibly imagine in that food with its farmer's face on it. And today, we're going to go searching for that culture with Mike Madison, who is a flower farmer and the author of a book entitled Blythe Farmer. Mike, welcome to the Food Chain.
Thanks. Let me correct one thing just before we start here.
Blast away.
The title of the book actually is Blythe Tomato.
Blythe Tomato, that's right. You're the Blythe Farmer.
Exactly.
Okay. Why Blythe? Where did you come up with that adjective anyway?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. It just popped into my head.
Uh-huh.
What can I say?
Good. So you're a flower farmer, which is to say you grow flowers and you sell them at a farmer's market, right?
Yeah, actually, that's one of my crops. We have a fairly diversified farm here.
Uh-huh.
So we have flowers and melons have been my two main field crops for a long time. But we also have orchards. We grow
What could be more fun than growing flowers and melons?
Well, I'll tell you, there's a little problem with flowers and melons, and that is that they grow down there on the ground, and somebody has to bend over and pick them up. It's called stoop labor.
Yeah.
And on my farm, it's a one-man farm. I don't have any employees. So I'm pretty much the guy out there picking those things up.
Yeah.
If you're 30 years old and you go out in the afternoon and you pick 45 crates of melons, well, then you're pretty tired and you walk back to the house and have a glass of wine. But if you're 60 years old and you go out in the field and pick 45 crates of melons, then you crawl home on your hands and knees and you drink the whole bottle. And I keep making this little calculation about how old I'm going to be when my youngest child finishes college. And I realize I need to get my crops up off the ground so I can work standing up.
There you go.
So 6 or 7 years ago, I started shifting into orchards.
Uh-huh.
And so we have apricots. We have clementine mandarins. We grow quince, which is a great crop. There's tremendous demand for it. And then I planted 1,200 olive trees for olive oil as well.
Wow. You know, this being a farmer, we're talking earlier before the program about the difference in being a farmer and being a grower, and you clearly have associated yourself with a farmer.
Right.
But being a farmer was not your first career, was it?
No, in a way it was. I grew up on a small farm here in Yolo County in the Sacramento Valley, and I began working on farms when I was a kid. We used to earn some pocket money in the summertime harvesting, processing tomatoes. Mm-hmm.
And like me, I bet the last thing you thought about doing when you grew up was to become a farmer, right?
Well, no, not really. I kind of enjoyed that stuff, actually. Uh-huh. I made a little money, and I liked working outside. But I didn't get into that right away. I went to university, studied botany, got a job as a plant collector in South America.
So you were working in the Amazon basin collecting plants?
Correct, huh?
Wow.
So I did that for about 7 years. And then I figured I'd had enough of that. I what started out to be a big adventure turned out to be hard work for low pay. And I came back here, worked in construction for a few years, and built up enough financial momentum that I was able to buy a farm and start farming.
Good. And you farm primarily for farmers markets and local grocery stores?
Correct. All my sales are within 8 miles of my farm.
Wow.
So probably two-thirds of my income is from the Davis Farmers Market, which is twice a week year-round.
Mm-hmm.
And the balance I sell to some supermarkets.
You know, in the beginning of this program, I characterized agriculture as growing in two directions. Did that kind of ring true to you?
Yeah, very much so. Sure. I mean, and I think that linguistic point you made about the difference between a grower and a farmer is certainly symptomatic of that. To my mind, the word grower conjures up a guy who has clean fingernails and a clean shirt and a cell phone on his belt and who is the employee of a corporation. Whereas a farmer is a guy who has dirty fingernails and a sweat-stained shirt and no cell phone, and he works for himself.
Well, let me ask you this. Why did you want to become a farmer instead of a grower?
Well, there's a whole collection of issues that go with that.
Right.
Just the nature of a small farm seemed to me to be ecologically much more congenial. And I'm just not a corporate kind of guy. I like to be independent, and I think that's typical of most of the small farmers. This is a gnarly bunch of individuals who probably would not do very well in a highly structured, corporate setting.
And with respect to agriculture, I made the comment that it seems to be growing in two directions, very big and very small, and there doesn't seem to be much peace and tranquility for those in the middle.
Yeah, it could be, yeah. I mean, it depends. Like in this area, there actually are a number of what you might call medium-sized farms of maybe 500 acres that are typically have a combination of tree crops, which would be walnuts or prunes, and maybe some row crops and tomatoes or something. And so they're kind of an in-between size, and they actually flourish pretty well. So there, at least locally, there are some medium-sized farms that do well. But I think nationally, the medium-sized farm of a few hundred acres is pretty much a vanishing species.
And yet there is opportunity for people who are smaller and selling directly to the consumer, such as yourself.
Yeah, I think actually I might be a minority of one on this. I think the future of small farms is very bright right now. As the global economy unravels, which it's certain to do, we have a return to more local kinds of economies that small farms will have an important role to play and will be very prosperous. At our farmers market, we have something like 120 farmers.
Wow.
Only two are younger than 40 years old. And the median age is probably closer to 60. And that's a little bit worrisome. I keep wondering, when we old guys kick the bucket, who's going to come take our places?
Yeah, that is worrisome. I also like to point out to consumers that they should be investing heavily in local agriculture as well, because should something happen to the large-scale agriculture, then, the consumer is going to be hard-pressed to find dinner.
Sure.
Where is the food going to come from? Well, you know, one of the things I wanted to talk about today was the culture of agriculture, because when you go shopping at a box store and you look at the food on the shelves and it's all brightly packaged and hermetically sealed, but there is no culture there. There's no people there. It's kind of like all of the people have been removed from the equation with the exception of a board checker. And yet when you go to a farmer's market, that's what you see. That's what the beauty of the place is. It's the people. And the people and their food, not only the people selling the food, not only the farmers, but the people buying the food are almost as equally as interesting. And one of the things that I really enjoyed about reading The Blythe Tomato was the people that you have in there. So I thought that what we could do is have a little fun with that and go from there. But first of all, I'd like to start with you, because you're an interesting person. When you talk about taking your flowers to the farmer's market, you once in a while take a Charlie Brown bouquet. What is that?
Well, because of my training as a botanist, but the flowers that appeal to me are often subtle ones or homely ones, you know, little native grasses or maybe a poppy. The petals have already fallen off. It's an immature fruit and things of that sort. So I liked them. Early on, I thought, I'll make these kinds of very subtle bouquets that really require some inspection and contemplation, and there should surely be a market for those things. And as it turned out, I was wrong. Subtlety does not sell very well in the farmer's market.
Or any market, right?
People want, big size and bright color and, sunflowers and red peonies and dahlias. Anything sort of big and splashy and ostentatious is a big hit.
Okay, folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking about the culture of the farmer's market, agriculture, with Mike Madison, who is a farmer and the author of The Blythe Tomato. And we're talking with you. We're going to be looking at the culture, the people of farmers market agriculture, and we'd like you to participate. If you know of any great personalities that you see at the farmers market, pick up your phone and join us today. We're at 831-479-1080 and 477-1340. Do stay tuned. Right back. Hello, there we go. Welcome back, folks. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking with Mike Madison, who is a farmer, a farmer's market farmer, which is as opposed to a grower. Mike farms up in Yolo County, California, and he sells everything within 8 miles of where he grows it. Compare that with much of agriculture, which happens or has a way of selling things to people 2,000 miles away. So there's a huge difference in the agriculture of our country now. One branch of agriculture is growing very, very big, and the other is growing very, very small. And we're talking about the culture of the small agriculture, those farmers who sell to local grocery stores, local restaurants, and above all, farmers markets and whatnot. And Mike Madison wrote a book called The Blythe Tomato, and he has a lot of observations about the culture of farmers market agriculture that we're going to pick up on today. And earlier, we were talking with Mike about the difference between agricultures, and Bill is calling with a question that will take us back there momentarily. Bill, welcome to The Food Chain.
Hello?
Yep, you're on. Fire away.
Well, good morning, Michael and Mike. I was wondering about your paperwork problems when you're answerable to the government for everything you do in agriculture nowadays. They just love it in government to have paperwork. But back in 1985, there was a huge scandal. Salinas Valley farmer put in a crop of watermelons, harvested them, shipped them to market. The consumers, a lot of them wound up in intensive care units poisoned by aldecarb.
That wasn't in the Salinas Valley. That was in the Central Valley.
Okay, I stand corrected. And I know that the crop was grown on land previously used for non-food purposes, so there was residuals in the topsoil layer.
The case there, the farmer used a systemic pesticide on a watermelon crop, which is just unbelievably stupid.
I was just curious about now how you handle such potential problems, and if the small farmer nowadays is overwhelmed by the paperwork problems, and how that makes
great question.
Anyway, that's all. Thanks.
Great question. Thank you very much for the call, Bill. Appreciate it. Let's go to Mike and get an answer. Mike,
I have a moderate amount of paperwork stuff I have to do. My the majority, although not in my entire farm, is farmed organically. So there's a huge amount of paperwork that's generated by the organic bureaucracy.
Right.
I have one pesticide that I use. It's an organic pesticide called GF120, made by Dow Chemical Company. It's actually made from an actinomycete, and it's used for controlling fruit fly on olives. Although it's a pretty benign pesticide, actually won a green award in Europe for being an environmentally safe pesticide. It's not listed for olives. It's one of the crops, and so I have to go through quite a bit of paperwork with the authorities. I have to file a notice of intent to spray before I spray, and then I have to file a spray report after I spray. And since I have to spray once a week for about 30 weeks, there's a whole lot of paperwork going back and forth.
Right.
The other side of the paperwork thing has to do with employees. And at one point in the past, I had tried hiring people, and I got enmeshed in this absolute nightmare of employment and workers' compensation stuff with the government, and decided that wasn't worth it. And I let the people go and went back to running a one-man farm. I'd love to be able to hire a high school student in the summertime to give me a hand or something like that, but if I comply with the law, it becomes a very difficult thing to do.
Well, that takes me back to what Bill was talking about, and the difference between a large farmer or a large grower and a small farmer. It seems like government steps in when it sees a problem and passes a law out of its best intentions, or sometimes maybe not its best intentions, but it passes a law forcing everybody to do things. Well, oftentimes a large-scale grower can spread those compliance charges over a much larger production than
sure.
it can a small farmer.
Yeah.
So it often, and this is not just agriculture, but this is endemic through all business,
right.
When government tries to protect what it often does is that it restricts or makes it much more difficult for somebody small to comply. Do you find that, I guess you do, with respect to just employees?
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, I'm not a libertarian by any means. I actually am a strong believer in government regulation.
Mm-hmm.
And it's nice to know that, you know, if I have some irresponsible neighbor down the road, that he's being prevented from, say, illicitly using an inappropriate pesticide.
Right.
For me to even be able to go and buy my olive oil or fruit fly spray from the vendor, I have to present paperwork showing that I am a licensed pesticide applicator and where it's going to be used and when it's going to be used. There are many checks and balances on that system so that an irresponsible person can't just get their hands on a toxic material. And I think that's appropriate. But to come back to your question, yeah, it certainly presents an obstacle.
Right. Well, you know, one of the fascinating things about your book, The Blythe Tomato, in reading it, I just fell in love with some of the characters because it's the characters that make farmers market agriculture so interesting.
Sure.
So let's go through some of them, and perhaps you could tell us a few of the stories. First of all, these farmers that you portray, these consumers that you portray, did you use their real names?
No, I did not use their real names.
Okay.
When I having been in the farmers market scene here for about 30 years, I've gotten to know most of the small farmers in this part of the state.
Right.
And what I discovered when I went to write about them was an ancient truth, and that truth is that virtue is boring, and that the interesting people were the ones with the flawed characters.
Uh-huh.
And so I obviously couldn't write about them with their real names.
Right. So who wants to hear a story about smooth sailing, right? Well, let's talk about some of the characters. Let me ask you a question. Why did Eric the Dane buy a Swedish tractor instead of an American one?
Yeah, this is an interesting character. He's the guy who from Denmark who had a really good practical education in farming, unlike most of the rest of us who are farming here.
Mm-hmm.
He's a very skilled farmer. But he came here and he started selling at farmers markets, and he quickly caught on to the realization that Americans seem to think that European things are superior to American ones. You know, a Volvo is a better car than a Chevrolet, and some
right.
French tomato is probably going to be better than a plain old early girl. So he began to exploit that, and his market identity came to be based on, you know, everything European, even though he had not been particularly a patriot when he was at home. And he sort of fell for his own propaganda, and when it was time to buy a tractor, he got a Volvo tractor imported through Canada. They're not sold in this country. And when he could have just bought a John Deere a mile down the road, and anyway, the Volvo turned out to be a lemon, and he kind of became the victim of his own joke there.
But with respect to that own joke, he was very clever in his marketing, wasn't he?
I guess so. I mean, he stumbled on a certain social fact and he exploited it.
Mm-hmm.
To me, he's a curious case because he was a very skilled farmer and he could have thrived just by being pretty, you know, straightforward and honest and humble. But he chose instead to be a little bit devious and you know, rename his cultivars with with bogus European names, that kind of thing.
Put a fancy French name on it and then raise the price by 50%,
exactly.
Right?
Yeah.
Okay, folks, this is the Food Chain. We're having a little fun talking about the culture of farmers market agriculture today. We've got Mike Madison, who's the farmer from Yolo County, California. Mike grows a various number of crops and sells them with all within about 8 miles of his farm, which is truly amazing in today's world. And he's also the author of The Blythe Tomato. So we're talking about some of the people Mike has met in his 30-year career of selling at farmers markets. And we're curious as to whether you know some interesting people at the farmers markets. If you do, pick up your phone and join us. 831-479-1080 and 477-1340. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. Do stay tuned. We don't want you to miss a thing. To market to the farmer's market for food with its farmer's face on it, ambiance that is small town friendly, and people that are as real as the goods in their hands. Just ask the Blythe farmer, Mike Madison, who is the Blythe farmer indeed, and also the author of The Blythe Tomato. Mike, let's talk a little bit about how Javier the Eggman promoted diversity.
Sure. This was a guy, I was actually set up next to him at the market for quite a while. I got to know him a bit. He's not a full-time farmer. He's an auditor for the Internal Revenue Service. But
interesting two careers, though, right?
Yeah, I would say.
And, of course, he was reporting all of his cash income.
I'm sure he was, yeah. Uh-huh. he had grown up on a goat ranch in Texas, and as a small kid had started raising chickens. And when he came up here to the Central Valley and went to work for the government, he still had an interest in chicken farming, and he eventually leased a 10-acre set up there and began raising chickens. And I think he keeps about 900 chickens. And he had a very interesting breeding program. He started out with about 15 different kinds of chickens, and he kept only Oricana roosters, and the rest of the roosters he sold, for butchering. And then so these Oricanas would breed with all these other...
What is an Oricana?
An Oricana is it's a type of chicken. It's a breed of chicken. They have sort of very dark, almost black feathers. Mm-hmm. And the head looks a little bit like a hawk. They don't have that big red comb on top that many other chickens do. They're very smart chickens and very interesting personalities. And they lay green eggs and blue eggs. So part of what the upshot of his chicken breeding operation was that he ended up with eggs of all different colors because he started out with some brown egg laying ones and these greens and blues, and he ended up with this incredible diversity of colors, but also of the great diversity of birds. Mm-hmm. And I had asked him about that. I thought, what are you trying to aim for here? And he said, well, he wasn't really sure. He wasn't actually a geneticist, but he remembered that the old chicken flocks down in Texas, where there was no particular control over breeding and where all different kinds of chickens were all breeding with each other, that you ended up with this sort of very diverse population of birds. And they tended to be very healthy. And much more so than, say, just a purebred, inbred line of white leghorns or some other kind of commercial chicken. And he was trying to replicate that in his own operation.
Well, he also ranged them as well, did he not?
Yeah, he had a very good system. He had four fields of about 2 acres each, and he would range the birds into one field, and while the other three were growing greens, he was buying expired lettuce seed and some clover seed and so on at a fairly cheap price. So he'd disc up the fields that didn't have chickens in them, and he'd grow the greens. And as they got up to, as the chickens finally demolished the field they were in, then he would move them over to the next yard. And chickens are commercially in a big, like, 100,000 chicken operation, the chickens are kept in little cages, and they're basically fed a synthetic food of some kind. It's based on grain with some antibiotics.
And you also have to believe that they have an economist watching carefully over each parcel of grain that each chicken gets, so that they have it down to a science on how to feed the chicken the absolute minimum to get the absolute maximum, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Whereas Javier, he's got these open fields with these chickens running around.
Right. And chickens are omnivores. They They eat bugs. They eat worms. They love greens. They eat all kinds of vegetation. And if you get the eggs from a free-ranging chicken, the color of the yolk is like an orange. It's not that pale yellow that you get from eggs in the store. I keep chickens running loose on my property here, probably to control earwigs in my citrus. Earwigs are a serious pest for me, and the chickens are just, they're really aggressive about earwigs. But once in a while, one of the chickens will catch a mouse. They're scratching around in the grass there, and they'll turn up a mouse. And then it gets to be something like a hilarious game of rugby, which all the chickens are chasing around this poor mouse trying to get a piece of it. But yeah, they're, you know, in the wild, they're not just grain eaters. They eat all kinds of
things. Right, right. So Javier's got essentially some pretty wild chickens of mixed breeds running around then. And so when he goes to the farmer's market, what do his eggs look like?
Well, they're all slightly different colors. They everything from a pretty clear green to an aqua color through sort of pale buff to medium brown to extremely dark chocolate brown eggs. And very makes it very interesting. He brings them in flats of 6x6 eggs,
mm-hmm.
and very interesting composition, just in itself. You know, people the color of eggs is very much a cultural thing. In the Deep South, people only eat white eggs. In the northeastern quadrant of the country, people eat brown eggs. But, in fact, eggs come in many different colors, and they're very interesting looking.
So how do consumers react to all of this diversity when they see Javier the Eggman with a flat of color?
Well,
I mean,
okay.
you go to the supermarket, and you get your choice between all white or all brown, and that's that. But here's Javier with a flat of a rainbow of colored eggs.
It depends on who the people are. One thing I've noticed in selling at the market over the years about the customers is that there are some people who are very businesslike, and they come in and they sort of look at what's there and they make a decision, they make their purchase, and they've got their money in their hand, they go on their way.
Mm-hmm.
And there are other people who are just
adventuring,
hopelessly indecisive. They can come in and if you've got a pile of 50 melons that are all the same, it'll take them 30 minutes to choose one. They just can't reach a decision.
Uh-huh.
And they're very frustrating customers to have. And the same people would come to the egg stand there, and for them to choose half a dozen eggs was like the most monumental undertaking of their week. They couldn't do it.
Well, how do they react to just the notion of diversity, you know, where you can buy so many different colored eggs? I mean, this is a kind of outside the American experience now,
yep.
where you can actually buy, you know, all of this diversity. There's no common color theme there. It's a riot of colors.
Yeah, I think, first of all, people are taken by surprise.
Right.
They say, wow, I didn't know eggs came in all these different colors. And they want to know if they came from different chickens and if one chicken would lay only one color of egg. And, you know, various kinds of questions like that. But people are impressed by it. And I think entranced by it.
Huh. And what benefit did Javier get? Let's go through that one more time. There's a lot of benefit from having all of these different breeds of chickens and the different colored eggs. And
well, I think there's a principle of ecology that you could summarize by saying that complexity creates stability. What that means is if you have a monoculture.
You're talking as a biologist now, right?
As a biologist here,
good. Fire away on this.
If you have a monoculture, say you have 1,000 acres of wheat that's all genetically identical, if you get a problem in there, that problem's going to spread through the whole thing. You get catastrophic failure. Whereas if you have a genetically diverse crop, whether it's wheat or chickens or whatever it is you're growing, and there's a disease organism comes into it, some parts of it are going to be resistant and some are not, and so that the disease will be limited rather than catastrophic. And I think that basically by having his diversified flock, he had the advantage of having a very healthy flock of birds.
Okay, folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking with Mike Madison about the culture of farmers market agriculture. And if you know of some good characters from your farmers market, we'd love to hear about it. 831-479-1080, 800-624-2665. Michael Olson, we will be right back with Mike Madison, so do stay tuned. We're going to talk about how Margot's marriage dissolved in the El Nino rains. So that's a fun story, so do stay tuned. Right back.
Get this.
The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of Metro Farm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. Metro Farm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. Metro Farm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. Metro Farm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of Metro Farm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Welcome back out there. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking with Mike Madison, the author of The Blythe Tomato. Would you consider yourself a Blythe farmer, Mike?
No, not really. I mean, the term Blythe implies, you know, sort of carefree.
Carefree, unconcerned, and you seem to be very caring and very concerned.
Yeah, actually, you know, one lady came up to me at the farmer's market, and she said, "I read your book. You're so grouchy. Your wife must be a saint to live with you."
But you did not come across as grouchy to me. You came across as an interested observer. And I can almost see you sitting at your booth at the farmer's market and watching the world come and go and picking out the interesting people and watching them and learning their stories. And one of the stories that really captivated me was the story of Margot, who was a farmer at the farmer's market and did quite well until...
Yeah, you know, actually, there's four different people have come up to me independently and said, "That story about Margot really needs to be made into a movie." it's so timely. It's a love story. It's about undocumented aliens and the poor farmer's market scene and the produce scene.
Well, take us from... she was a farmer, right? She
showed up... Margot was a... you know, a woman in her mid-30s who came to our area from the East Coast. She came from a wealthy family, and I don't know quite... I never met her. I spoke to her on the phone one time, but I never actually met her in person. She... and I only heard her story years later from a friend of mine who'd worked for her.
Mm-hmm.
But she came to our area. She started out as an apprentice on a little organic farm, and within 3 months, she was the manager of the farm. And by the next year, she struck out and started farming on her own. She was a very energetic person, very good grower, and a fearless negotiator. And she got a diversified vegetable and fruit operation going, selling to restaurants and to farmers markets. And she fell in love with one of her...
Before you go there, she really built this business up into a substantial operation, didn't she?
Yeah. I mean, we were, you know, around, sort of for the little one-man farms around here, if you gross $100,000 a year, that's considered pretty good.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, she was more than double that right out of the gate. And she just had the business sense, I guess, and the chutzpah to ask high prices and to...
make
commitments and keep them. So, right. Yeah, it was an impressive show from that point of view. Anyway, she fell in love with one of her undocumented workers, a young guy named Narciso, who was only half her age. And she didn't speak any Spanish, and he didn't speak any English. And so it was, an interestingly developing relationship there that had to be...
The universal language, right?
A universal language. And, of course... You know, they're together all the time handling produce, and I imagine this movie, this sort of about half about the sensuality of produce. That
I could just see them holding melons together or something,
exactly,
you know?
Yeah.
Oh, God, yeah. All right.
So anyway, she eventually decided to marry him, and they went to the county courthouse and got married, and then as soon as they had their marriage certificate, they went to see an immigration lawyer about getting a green card for Narciso. Well, it turned out the immigration lawyer interviewed them. It turned out that Narciso already had a wife and two children in Mexico. So the marriage was annulled, but they kept living together and had a baby. And then after that, that was the year 1998 that there was this El Nino current in the Pacific, and we had these absolutely tremendous rains in the spring. We had, at least in this county, it was the wettest year in 100 years, and it kept on raining all the way up until June. I mean, it was just, it was a tough year for all of us. And she, somehow she had her baby, and her interest in her farm had been transferred onto this infant, and she just lost interest in it and closed up her farm and went back to wherever it was she came from on the East Coast. Yeah. Something there was another story actually in that book about a slightly similar thing about, I think in some cases, a woman who's maybe approaching the end of her child-bearing years and hasn't yet had a child and is, you know, feeling her clock ticking.
And hanging around the fecundity of a farm, right?
Yeah. Sometimes gets kind of diverted into producing fruits and vegetables as kind of a trial run at motherhood.
Uh-huh.
You know, and I think maybe there was some element of that in there.
And that's exactly what happened. She scored her crop and closed up shop and disappeared.
Yeah, exactly.
What about some of the shoppers at the farmer's market? You tell a wonderful story about... A young grad student, Pete.
Oh yeah.
Who discovered in the farmer's market a great way to have a cheap date.
Yeah, this is the guy. He, I think he must have been, by the time I was writing, he was maybe 45 years old. He was still an undergraduate. He had managed to stretch out his college career to something like 25 years. Going to school, and he would take one.
And he was studying girls, right?
He was studying girls. Yeah, his real interest in the university was to meet women, and he was, you know, he was a tall, handsome, charming kind of guy, and so he had a lot of success in that department. And he had figured out the perfect cheap date, which was that he would come to the farmer's market, and he'd bring a couple of bottles of beer in a paper bag instead of buying from the local microbrewery at $3 a glass. And they'd go to one of the food stands, the nighttime market there, and get, you know, some sushi or empanadas or whatever for dinner. And then you could go sit on the grass and listen to the band. There's live music at this Wednesday night market. And then he'd always have me set aside a little cheap $2 bunch of flowers for him that he could give to his date. So he managed to, you know, pull off his date with dinner, drinks, live music, and flowers for about $8.
And had a great time doing it.
Yeah.
Okay, folks, this is The Food Chain. I'm going to take a quick break. When we come back, we're going to go to Linda, who has a quick question. And about potatoes, I think. So do stay tuned. 800-642-665, 831-479-1080. Michael Olson, this is The Food Chain. We're talking with Mike Madison, the Blythe farmer of the Blythe tomato fame. Do stay tuned. Right back. Welcome back, folks. This is The Food Chain. We're talking about the culture of farmers market agriculture with Mike Madison, who is the author of The Blythe Tomato. And we have a question from Linda, who's calling in with a question on potatoes and also about the essential quality of the food we eat. Linda, welcome to The Food Chain. Fire away.
Thank you. Hello, Mr. Madison.
Hello.
Okay, this is about store-bought potatoes. I've noticed this for about the last year or two. I quarter my potatoes.
Uh-huh.
Sometimes I peel them, then I boil them, and then eat them. Now, sometimes right after dinner or maybe the next day, the chunks are gray. I was wondering what that is, or if you've heard of that, seen it.
Your potatoes are turning gray.
Yeah, after being cooked.
Yeah, I think there's probably some kind of oxidation going on there, but I'm not enough of a food scientist to be able to answer that question entirely. You know, it's possible that the potatoes have been in storage quite a long time. They may have been in storage in an oxygen-free atmosphere, which may have somehow affected their chemistry. But I don't actually know that for sure. I'm just kind of speculating.
Do you see the same thing with farmers market potatoes, Linda?
I haven't bought those. I should actually
try
that.
Hey, girl, give it a try.
Will do.
All right, thanks for the call. Okay, Mike, got a couple minutes left. You know, 10 years ago, farmers markets were few and far between. Today, they're ubiquitous. They're taking over entire cities. Even my hometown of Billings, Montana, it has a farmers market that's quite literally taking over the downtown and bringing life to downtown and bringing people back to downtown. Where are we going with farmers markets?
Yeah, you know, that's a very interesting thing about the markets. I mean, we've had farmers markets in this country since colonial times.
Right.
And after World War II, they went into pretty steep decline as the customers defected over to supermarkets. And then in the 80s, they started making a big revival, and now they're just our most vital social institution. The revival of farmers markets, I think, coincided with the global economy and the rise of computers, and I believe there's some association in those things, in that, you know, the typical worker in a global corporation goes to her cubicle, logs on, spends the day looking at the flickering screen, doing business with somebody who she's never met in a country she's never been to. And it's a very alienating kind of way of life. She's cut off from her community, from her food supply and her work.
Sure.
And to come to the market is like a way of reconnecting to real life as opposed to, you know, virtual life. And being among real people, and the music is live. It's a little bit out of tune because it hasn't been digitally remastered and that kind of thing. And it's a very satisfying kind of experience.
And conversely, going to the big box stores is just a continuation of that sitting in the cubicle kind of life.
Sure, sure. Yeah, I mean, there's you know, you get a frozen food-like object product of Argentina. You're supposed to put it in the microwave. There's really no connection to who grew it or where it came from or what it is.
What is, as a practitioner of farmers market agriculture for, what, 30 years now?
Uh-huh.
What is your favorite thing about this whole world of agriculture as opposed to conventional agriculture? What is it that makes it for you, Mike Madison?
Well, first of all, I just enjoy the process. It's intellectually challenging. The whole ecosystem of my farm is very complex, and so there's always, you know, interesting riddles to solve. That's one side of it. But the other side of it is actually connecting with the end users of my products. Because
so it keeps you thinking and hopping and everything. Mike Madison, we ran out of time. Thank you so much for joining us, and thank you out there for tuning in. Stay tuned next week for more What's Eating What Radio right here on the Food Chain. And remember, cheap food isn't. Thank you so much, Mike.
Great. Thanks a lot. Bye-bye.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.